Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
People in Haiti, when they go to the streets, they have signs asking the U.S. to help stop the flow of deadly weapons that are being used by the gangs to sow chaos.
The latest from Port-au-Prince as violent gangs consolidate power in Haiti. It's Wednesday, March 20th, the first full day of spring. And this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, what you need to know about the Texas immigration law allowing local officials to arrest and deport migrants after a legal back and forth involving the Supreme Court. Also, expert witnesses in foster care court are using unscientific methods to recommend kids stay with temporary guardians instead of birth relatives.
She had based her evaluation on less than 2 hours of meeting with the foster parents, who again were her clients. She just concluded that the foster parents should get to keep the child permanently.
That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But first, Haiti is inching towards a new government, but terror in the streets has only gotten worse. A transitional council is supposed to choose an interim prime minister and prepare for new elections soon. But as elites vie for power, the country is effectively under the rule of violent gangs. We reached Widlor Marincourt in the capital today. He's the editor-in-chief of Ayibo Post, and he spoke with Deepa Fernandez.
So you're downtown Port-au-Prince right now. What are you seeing and hearing? And Widlor, I'm thinking of the fancy suburb of Pétionville, you know, that seemed so impenetrable. Has the gang violence reached places like that where Haiti's elite live?
In downtown Port-au-Prince, we have violence. You know, they attacked the national penitentiary really close to the Haitian National Palace the last weeks. And then they move the violence to lower part of Delma and, you know, more and more the upper part of the Haitian capital, the areas of La Boule, the areas of, you know, Thomassin, the areas of Pétionville are targeted by gang violence. But increasingly, or the vast majority of the victim in Haiti today are the poor people, the merchants, the very people that for the past decades in this country were already suffering.
Okay, so I understand how vulnerable poor people are and have been, but I want to understand, who are these Haitian elites who are now targeted, and why up to this point have they been immune to gang violence?
As of March 2024, Canada has imposed sanctions on about 28 Haitian elites, politicians, folks in the business sector, and the U.S. also has imposed sanctions on many of them. And we have Gilbert Bidzio, for instance, who is probably the richest man in Haiti. And you have a former president, Michel-Joseph Martelly. You have former prime ministers. And these are the people who allegedly, you know, have ties to nefarious sectors in Haiti that are contributing to the chaos that you're seeing in the streets today.
So given that, Widlor, you know, now you have the leaders of CARICOM, which is the Organization of Caribbean Nations, arranging this transitional council. You know, how much are Haitian people feeling like a transitional council will be the way forward?
Well, so many experts are pointing out today in Haiti how potentially dysfunctional a council with 9 members, 7 have, you know, voting powers, could be. This is something that people feel unease about, but they feel more comfortable about the fact that today the overall majority of the meetings where the future of Haiti is being discussed are not happening physically inside Haiti. And in some of these instances, you have 0 Haitians present in the room. And this war process does not feel like the solution.
You know, one of the things that we've been hearing is that so many of the guns, the weapons in Haiti that are doing so much of this killing are flowing in from the United States. Is there any talk about what the U.S. could do there?
People in Haiti in protests, when they go to the streets by the thousands, you know, they have signs asking the U.S. to help stop the flow of deadly weapons, sometimes military-style weapons, that are being used by the gangs today to sow chaos and attack poor neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince. And, you know, reports from the own Justice Department of the U.S. are showing how most of the guns that are being sent by Haitian authorities for tracing comes from the U.S.
Has that come up for discussion? Has the U.S. responded that that is something actionable it could take care of?
I haven't heard of any new policies or any new actions. So far, we are not seeing, you know, high profile, many results.
I just want to end by asking you what you think Whitlaw needs to happen to bring about some measure of safety and peace for the people of Port-au-Prince and Haiti?
What I can say for sure is I'm 33 years old, and this is the first time I'm seeing that level of suffering in this country. And it is also unusual for the world to be so silent and in some corners so unconcerned by the plight of hundreds of thousands of people that are, you know, being killed, you know, by gangs here in Haiti. So something has to happen. I don't know what it is. It's not my role to say what it should be, but at a human level, it's untenable.
That's Whitlaw Maracor, editor-in-chief of Aibo Post, and also a reporter for our editorial partners at The Washington Post. Whitlaw, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Texas's fight with the federal government over authority to arrest and deport migrants was back in court this week. Even the Supreme Court stepping in has not resolved the status of the law. When we return, Deepa gets us up to speed on where things stand and what it means for people on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Migrants in Texas are expressing fear and uncertainty after a confusing back and forth over that new controversial Texas immigration law. The law lets local and state police arrest people in the country without documentation and allows a state judge to order them deported. Yesterday, the Supreme Court allowed the state to move forward with the law, at least temporarily. But hours later, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed that, blocking Texas from enforcing the law. And today, the court has been holding a hearing on the law. Let's bring in Daniel Morales, a professor of law at the University of Houston. Professor, welcome.
It's great to be here.
So many courts, so many rulings, Professor. It's very confusing. We know the law has been debated at the Fifth Circuit today. What happens next in this case?
What happens next is the court needs to decide whether to issue a permanent stay on the lower court's order. From my read of the court today, I expect that the court will continue to not let the law go into effect, at least in part.
Okay, and that panel today, three judges, one George W. Bush appointee, one Trump appointee, one Biden appointee, interesting court there. Do you think that the Supreme Court will be stepping in again on this case?
I would expect so, yes. It's too important an issue for them to ignore.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the details here, because as we watch this kind of battling between the courts, I'm thinking that many legal scholars thought this Texas law didn't even stand a chance, given the century plus of precedent that holds only the federal government can make and enforce immigration laws. So I'm wondering, Professor, does Texas actually have a good case here?
Not under existing precedent at all. I think what was interesting today in argument was that the George Bush appointee that you mentioned focused in on the fact that Texas's argument sounded a lot like Justice Scalia's dissent in the binding case Arizona v. U.S. And so if we're just looking at past precedent, then no, Texas doesn't have a case. However, right, we have a different, very different court than we've had. And as with Roe v. Wade being overturned, and other sort of longstanding precedents, Republican state legislatures and state actors more broadly are taking advantage of the 6-3 conservative majority on the court and wondering and testing whether they will revisit old precedents and issue similar reversals as they did to Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision.
Okay, and then that 2012 Supreme Court ruling in favor of the federal government's power to enforce immigration in the case where Arizona enacted a similar law. This Texas law goes even further than that one that was not allowed to stand because it allows the state to deport some people seeking asylum. How unprecedented is that, and what are the implications?
It's quite unprecedented. The asylum rules that sort of govern today came out of World War II, and we have sort of stuck by our treaty commitments over time. There's certainly been some incursions on asylum, but that is the biggest problem that this Texas law poses. So, for example, if you cross at a port of entry at an unauthorized port of outside the ports of entry, right? If you just cross the border where there isn't a border patrol station, say, you might be subject to federal expedited removal, which is a sort of very quick process of going back from whence you came. But if you can express a particularized fear of persecution should you return to your home country, you usually, if you meet the threshold standards, are allowed to apply for asylum. And that's the really problematic part of this law, because it interferes with that process. And in fact, expressly permits the state to prosecute people even if they have pending asylum claims with the United
States.
Even if
they're already in a process. Got it. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the big things as well is that Mexico has said it's not going to accept any deportations made by Texas. How big a deal is that?
It's completely unsurprising, and it's a very predictable part of the problem with what Texas is doing here. The federal government already has difficulty returning some folks back to their countries of origin for various reasons. And as you can imagine, that's a complex set of negotiations that happens between countries. Mexico clearly stating that it won't cooperate with Texas is a way of highlighting that broader issue for the courts as they make these decisions.
Yeah, and we heard a Texas sheriff on Morning Edition who supported the law, but he said it would cost too much. I'm also wondering if law enforcement, local law enforcement, even understand immigration law to know who might have a reason to be in the country.
They generally do not. And that's the big, that's another huge part of this. Local law enforcement, I expect, and the city of Houston has said they do not plan on spending a lot of resources to enforce the law. And frankly, most people who are undocumented in Texas and everywhere have been here for a long time. And so it seems that the statute of limitations would actually bar them being prosecuted.
Daniel Morales is a professor of law at the University of Houston.
Coming up, kids can end up in foster care when they've been abused or abandoned. But whenever possible, the goal of that system is to reunite them with relatives. That isn't the case in practice, however, with more foster parents intervening to get permanent custody. Those parents often call on attachment experts to make their case, but those experts have been accused of peddling junk science. Robin Young has the story when we return.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
A prominent social worker whose testimony has helped separate foster children from their birth families has now been accused of peddling junk science. And she said to reporters that, in fact, an investigation into her work has prompted self-examination, prompted her to be more honest with herself. For decades, Diane Baird has been an expert witness in trials that determine who has custody of children, their foster parents, who start to feel an attachment, or their birth families, even when those families have been identified by officials as safe. Well, now, under scrutiny from reporters at The New Yorker and ProPublica, and during questioning from a lawyer in a deposition, Diane Baird says her methods are completely unscientific. And this is all calling into question not just the outcomes of trials she's been involved with, but the very purpose of family court. And it also questions the major institution Diane Baird is affiliated with, the University of Colorado. Eli Hager is a reporter with ProPublica. He joins us now. Eli, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Eli, remind us, foster care is supposed to be temporary, and family, birth family, or relatives are thought to be the end goal of foster care, to get them back, to reunify them?
Right. Under federal law and laws in all 50 states, the primary objective of foster care is for it to be temporary. In other words, for the child to be returned home to the child's birth parents if it's safe to do so and the parents have completed their treatment plan, or second best, to identify a birth family member like a grandmother, for example, to place that child with in order to preserve that child's sense of identity and family heritage.
Well, this has been upended by a lot of things, but you write one of those is a need for adoption and foster families, kind of blurring the line between what should be fostering and their need and their want to adopt. But also, this is happening, it seems, because of people like Diane Baird. She calls herself an attachment expert, and she also claims to practice something called the Kemp protocols. What are each of those?
Right. So an attachment expert is somebody who comes in and is often hired by foster parents or in some cases by other officials and testifies to the fact that the foster parents are too attached to the child for the child to be returned back to birth family as is supposed to be the goal of the foster system. And the Kemp Center is a branch of the University of Colorado. It's been around for 50 years, and it's considered the nation's leading academic institute focused on child welfare, and that's where Diane Baird got her start.
Well, and so the Kemp Center, just to be clear, at the University of Colorado, has done things that people within the field commend. They were behind mandated reporters, people who were charged with reporting if they thought children were being abused, for instance. But what have they said about the Kemp protocols?
So the Kemp protocol is something that Diane Baird and a few of her colleagues developed in the 1980s and 90s. Diane Baird has admitted that it was never published. It's remained pretty much unchanged since the 1980s. It doesn't have validity or reliability. The Kemp Center, despite all of this, has refused to publicly disavow the protocol, instead privately asking Diane Baird to stop using the Kemp name and telling ProPublica that this type of methodology is not best practice in these cases, but not going so far as to disavow it or to ask her to cease and desist.
Well, this is both heartbreaking and enraging because she has been practicing it. And you start off with one case. It's a child who has visitation rights with the grandmother. Those visits seem to go beautifully. The grandmother seems to be showering this child with love, wants this child to be with her. And yet enter Diane Baird, who posits this attachment theory. It's in a deposition with a lawyer representing that grandmother that we hear Diane answer questions about her theories. What did she say?
So she admitted in the protocol that she had been hired by the foster parents and was being paid by the foster parents who had heard about her from other foster parents. She also admitted that her protocol was unscientific. She admitted that she had no knowledge of the child's cultural heritage. This was a child of biracial heritage, and part of the reason in these cases for wanting to keep children with their birth families is to preserve those cultural ties, and also that she had based her evaluation on less than 2 hours of meeting with the foster parents, who again were her clients, and she had not met the grandmother or read any case documents in the case. She just concluded that the foster parents should get to keep the child permanently. But Diane Baird would argue that rupturing the attachment of any child under 3 years old is going to cause long-term harm. So if a child has become attached to their foster parents, then by definition, you know, returning them to their birth family would be, quote unquote, breaking an attachment, which she says will cause long-term problems. That's what she would argue. So there is still some substance to the idea that this could affect children.
Well, we should note, and you do, that there are others like Dorothy Roberts, who's a law professor and sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, who's, as you write, a leader of the movement to abolish the whole child welfare system because it's widespread separation of Black families in particular, that they would argue that the most important thing is the reunification with a birth family and with a cultural identity.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think a lot of the social science research suggests that kids who grow up with their own families end up with more sibling connections, more extended family connections, fewer mental health and behavioral problems when they become adolescents, and a greater sense of self and of their cultural identity when they're adults. So these are the reasons why the law gives preference to kin, to biological family in these decisions, and attachment experts like Diane Baird are kind of arguing in the face of those realities.
And some of the other things ProPublica found are so damning. She sometimes just copies and pastes past evaluations onto new ones. And this idea of hiring someone, and so you're paying them, so it would seem that they would want to rule in your favor. This is called intervener strategy. Talk about that.
Right. So ProPublica, along with The New Yorker last October, we wrote about the growing nationwide phenomenon of foster parents intervening in family court cases. This is in the context of adoption plummeting. In other contexts, international adoption has become extremely difficult. Private adoption has become extremely expensive. And so there's this plan C, kind of, which is to adopt from foster care. And one of the things that foster parents can do if they want to keep a child or to adopt a child is to, quote unquote, intervene in the case, which gives them the full rights of a full party to the case. So they can start filing motions, calling witnesses, cross-examining witnesses. And they do these things to argue that they're extremely attached to the child and the child to them. And that therefore the child should not be reunited with the child's birth family, even if the county or the state agency is saying that they found a birth family member who's a safe placement, and so they're kind of counteracting that goal of the foster system by intervening.
Right. Well, and you write that after ProPublica published this article with The New Yorker, you started to hear from faculty at the Kemp Center, people saying this was a gut punch to read. It's a tragedy. It diminishes all the good work we've done and continue to do. You know, what does the birth grandmother say about this acknowledgement that this is junk science, and yet, lest you leave us with her, it's kept her from her granddaughter?
Right. And it should be noted that in these cases, the grandmother is often, you know, very close with the child. Technically, birth parents have more rights than grandparents, as the actual parents. But in this and many other cases, the grandparents are visiting frequently. They've developed a bond themselves with the child, and they desperately want to keep these children in their families, and especially if they have Native American or Hispanic heritage, like many people do in Colorado. They want to hold on to some of those cultural traditions and heritage. So all of those things were lost by the result of this case, which was heavily influenced by Diane Baird's recommendation. Although versions of this exist around the country with foster parents hiring attachment experts to make some of these same arguments.
And again, just for people thinking, well, shouldn't the children's safety be the biggest concern? This is in cases where the birth family has been designated, or a birth relative has been designated by officials, the safe place. And it's when these pseudoscientists intervene that changes. Eli Hager, reporter for ProPublica, will link you to their reporting at herenow.org. Eli, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan and Gabrielle Healy. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, and Micaela Rodriguez. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel.
Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.